sit there and suck the thumb. Hear the rock and roll roar. But you're just a paisley wallflower. Do you join all your friends on the floor and do the brain tap shuffle? Lose your mind, you'll see the ocean is part. You'll think you're going blind. You can talk about your daily.
All right, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Today my guest is Brian Sweet. He's the author of what was really the first book ever published that was exclusively about Steely Dan. It's called Reelin' in the Years. It was first published in 1994. It has come out in several editions since, and, you know, in a way, it's kind of the foundational history of the band. It covers the entire saga from the beginning to the present, and most remarkably, it was written in a pre-internet age when there was still quite a bit not known about the backgrounds of Donald Fagen and Walter Becker. So, quite an achievement. I do recommend seeking out a copy of that. It's essential for all Steely Dan fans. Brian also created Metal Leg, which was the first Steely Dan fanzine. That was started all the way back in 1987. Brian is from the UK, but has taken many trips across the Atlantic over the years to see Steely Dan live. You know, Brian was really one of the first people to do a kind of Steely Dan fan thing. You know, he was doing this stuff before any kind of organized fandom existed. So it was an honor and a pleasure to have Brian on the podcast. Special thanks to Barney Hurley for helping make the connection. And also want to give special thanks to my friend Alex Hahn, who did some of the audio cleanup for me on this one. One other quick thing before I share my chat with Brian. I mentioned on last month's episode with Zamari Jones that starting in October, some of the old episodes of Gaucho Amigos would go behind a paywall. And sure enough, you'll notice if you scroll down the Apple podcast feed, some of the older episodes are now tagged as subscriber only. If you try and hit play on the episode, it triggers the option to subscribe to FM Pods for $4.99 a month. Now, this is simply to encourage people to subscribe to my podcast network, FM Pods. And, you know, it's really just a way to get some support, some financial backing for Gaucho Amigos. I'll take the money I earn from your subscriptions and put it back into the podcast. I'll always keep new episodes for free. They'll always be free and accessible to everyone for a minimum of 60 days. And, you know, I'll also leave a couple of the older episodes free as well. I'll be kind of rotating those around. But if you like the podcast and you want all access all the time and you want to support Gaucho Amigos, you know what to do. Hit that subscribe button. Also, starting later this month, I'll be sharing the first Gaucho Amigos bonus episode. I'll be putting up one of those every month. Again, subscriber only. And I'm in the very early stages of putting together a little bonus podcast series. It looks like me and a former guest of the show will be doing some podcasting together. Won't be an interview show, and we're still in the very early stages of figuring that out, but stay tuned for details on that. All right? All right, without further ado, this is my conversation with Brian Sweet, the author of Steely Dan Biography, Reelin' in the Years. Enjoy.
I wanted to read a book about Steely Dan. Obviously, I couldn't find one because there wasn't one. I had all this material, and I thought maybe I could, you know, have a crack at it myself. So I sent a letter off to Omnibus Press, who obviously specialised in music books, and said I'd been doing the fanzine for a while. And they wrote back and said they were interested, and it all kind of went from there, really. So Yes, quite an obsession, really.
So when did the obsession start? Like, what year was that? Was it while Steely Dan was still making records, or was that after Gaucho?
Yes, I think the obsession probably would have been about 1978, because I knew, you know, Do It Again, Reeling in the Years, Ricky W's That Number, etc., etc. But I bought the Greatest Hits album and discovered all these other songs. I thought, you know, wow. Went from there, really. So probably around about 78. And I visited Los Angeles in 82. And I was buying Goldmine magazine and trying to find the Navasota album, you know, because they'd written one song on there. Lots of perusing of magazines and looking for rarities, you know. Of course, this Schlitz commercial, which has recently appeared, was a little gem.
Yeah. In 78, yeah. did you go out and buy Asia as well?
Yes. Yep. Certainly did. And I can remember clearly to this day, I was listening to the radio one afternoon in 1980. And we have an American DJ over here called Paul Gambaccini.
Okay.
Very good DJ, extremely knowledgeable. Anyway, I knew that Gaucho was coming out, and he did like an American hit radio show. And he played Babylon Sisters before Gaucho was even released. When I heard that intro, you know, Bernard Purdy's drums, and then Donald's voice comes in, hair on the back of the neck went up, you know, still remember that. It was a Saturday afternoon, very, very clear in my mind, you know.
You heard Babylon Sisters on the radio, and then I presume you got Gaucho when it came out. What was your initial reaction to that?
Oh, well, I mean, I love the cover, I have a you know, Gaucho poster on my wall along with Asia, and, you know, I bought so much stuff, really, it's untrue. I loved the album. Fantastic, you know, the title track, Glamour Profession, et cetera, you know. And then, of course, you have the incredible time, Third World Man, which was a remake of Were You Blind That Day? And I knew there had been a song called Were You Blind That Day, because I have this very large scrapbook of, you know, cuttings and stuff. And I think Music Gig did an interview with Donald in 1976. And they must have been at the studio. And that was the song that Donald mentioned. He said, we have a song called Were You Blind That Day? Of course, when Asia came out, it wasn't on there, you know.
Right.
So to hear the reworking of Were You Blind That Day into Third World Man, yeah, amazing stuff.
And now there are demos of Were You Blind That Day that are out there on the internet, and I've heard those, and they're great as well. So
they are, yes. This is the thing, isn't it? I mean, there must be some cracking tunes in the archives and in the vaults, because they didn't put them out on the box set and so on. So, yeah, there must be some real crackers around.
Yeah, and some of them are slowly leaking out. And I do want to talk about that, but let's kind of like work chronologically. So, you know, what was your reaction? Do you remember when, like, what was your reaction to finding out that Steely Dan wouldn't be doing another album after Gaucho? Was there kind of a definitive moment where you learned that information, or was it just kind of clear over time that they weren't going to do another album?
Yes, it was clear, because I think they did an interview with the New York Times in 1981 with Robert Palmer, and it was Donald and on his own, and he said, you know, I'm afraid Steely Dan are gone, you know, they are no more. Nothing is planned, you know, we'll see what happens further down the line. I think at that point it was pretty clear to me that certainly wouldn't, I think, would be happening Steely Dan-wise for some years.
But then Donald came out with the Nightfly shortly after that. So were you
That's right, yes.
excited for that album?
Yes. Loved it because, yeah, I went to the States in 82, just by coincidence. We only went to LA and that, with a couple of friends. And we drove up from LA to San Francisco and went across to Vegas and stuff. But yeah, loved the Nightfly. I mean, a lot of critics and a lot of writers sort of said, so what did Walter Becker do towards Steely Dan, didn't they? Somewhat unfairly, of course.
Yeah.
Obviously had Gary Katz and Roger Nichols and all the studio musicians, and Walter did not co-write the songs, did he? So that was the main difference there, really. But wonderful album. Just a shame he didn't make a few more in the 1980s.
Yeah, and there are some singles here and there, right? There's, stuff like the song he did for Bright Lights, Big City and The King of Comedy. I know he did, those soundtrack songs. And
yes.
But yeah, it wasn't until Comic Curiad that he made a full comeback. So during this 80s period when, there was no Steely Dan and no other Donald albums, how did you kind of keep your obsession going? What kind of, stoked your flame in terms of your interest in Steely Dan? Like, what would you, collect or?
I certainly, bought all the Premiere magazines with Donald's, film reviews or, little bits in there. Like you say, it was the finer things and heavy metal and, those little soundtrack bits and like the Jennifer Warren's thing. And then of course, Walter, late 80s, was producing China Crisis. And I only wish I'd known actually that Walter came over to the UK in 86 to produce Flaunt the Imperfection, because I would have gone to the studio and ambushed him. But obviously I didn't know until after the fact, that he'd come over here and stayed for a few weeks and produced the album. And then when they did Diary of a Hollow Horse, of course they went to Maui, so lucky China Crisis, really.
Yeah, I actually didn't. I don't think I realized that he did another one with them. Interesting. I thought he just did the one. So I'll have to go find that album. So how are you finding all these, magazine bits and songs? And are you just kind of keeping your eye out open for them?
Yes. Not quite so much these days, because of course it's all kind of online, isn't it? Like I say, back then I was importing magazines. Spending a fortune on airmail postage on getting these articles and cutting them out and putting them into my scrapbook, as I call it. I put all the reviews of the albums together and then got the interviews, chronologically from 72, through to, whatever the latest was, so anything really worthwhile now, I just get it off the internet and, print it.
There are a lot of kind of younger folks getting into Steely Dan now, but it's all happening, of course, in these virtual spaces online and communities like Twitter, Discord, Reddit. And I think it's probably unimaginable to them that someone, like yourself would be, literally importing magazines and newspapers and, vinyl copies of radio interviews, but that's how you were doing it, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'd find something in Goldmine and I'd put in a bid on it, and it would have been $40 or something like that, I guess, and hope that I won the bid, and be really excited waiting for it to arrive and, couldn't wait to listen to it. And have you ever heard the Robert Klein radio show interview?
I believe I have. Yeah, I know on YouTube there are quite a few of their radio interviews are on there now, and I've listened to I think just about all of them.
1980 in New York, and there were quite a few around actually, back then.
Did you enjoy hearing Donald and Walter's kind of patter?
Yes, very much, very much.
Yeah, when they would get into a groove, it's almost like, because it's like two minds melded into one. So, it's like they have a certain patter. There was that, I think it was Barney Hoskins. There's a compilation of interviews from various magazines and newspapers with Steely Dan from over the 70s.
Major Dudes.
Major Dudes, yeah. I love that just because I love the... I love being able to, read all those interviews because Donald, they're just so funny, they're just so, so funny. And they had such a great rapport, and to be able to see them, trading, these witticisms. As a fan, that's a real joy for me. So.
Yes. Yeah.
And unfortunately we never got, a more of a kind of documentary, although there's that one, I don't know if I would imagine you've seen it, but it's called Classic Albums Asia. It was an hour TV broadcast.
Yes. Yeah. I think I have the DVD actually. That's good. Got Dean Parks on there and Ian Dury and all that kind of thing, haven't you? So it's amazing who you find our Steely Dan fans, really.
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, this Twitter thing, it's gotten kind of nutty how many people are really obsessed with Steely Dan. And I'm talking about people who are, my age and younger, like mostly younger. So they've kind of become this cult object, like especially those 70s records. I mean, kids that were born in the 90s or even into the 2000s are obsessed with Steely Dan, especially with, kind of the Asia Gaucho era. So like for example that Classic Albums Asia movie, like they've all seen it because it's on YouTube. They can access these things a lot more easily than even I could when I was a kid. So people have memorized the funny lines that Donald Walter said have said, or they're remixing, they're using memes and remix culture to kind of play with this stuff. So tell me about Metal Leg. How did that start? And just tell the listeners what that is. Because again, a lot of these listeners, they're younger, so they probably don't even know about it.
Yeah, I think Metal Leg began in 1987. So by then, I'd collected quite, a ream of stuff, really, on Steely Dan. So I had all this information. And I just kind of wanted to share it, really. And as I said before, obviously Steely Dan really didn't even exist in 1987 as an entity. And fanzines were around. I thought, well, I could, have a bash at doing one for Steely Dan. So I did, I thought, just do one each sort of quarter. I think the first issue I transcribed some of the KPFK interview, but it was such an extensive interview. It had to be over three issues of the magazine, I think, so.
And so how did you publish the first edition? Like, what was that process like?
Yeah, well, I just went to, I had an old, 1987, I had like an Amstrad word processor, saying it sounds so ancient. I did it on the word processor and just tried to, use some photographs that I had from magazine articles, etc., and took it to a local, print shop, and they printed me up, a number of copies, and took some ads in magazines, and away we went, really.
So did you put them around London? I mean, where were they? Where were you putting
it? I'm in Somerset, so okay. It was all just done, around here, really.
And how did you know? I mean, did you have some sort of readership? I mean, how did you know who was reading?
Well, as I took ads in, like Record Collector magazine, and I placed an ad in Rolling Stone to get some American, just a little ad at the back of the magazine, and so it just gradually, expanded really, pre-internet. So I would get stuff in the mail and, send out the magazine each quarter. So
So you would do 4 a year?
yes,
And for how
yeah,
long were you doing it?
I did from about 1987 to 1990, something like that. And then what happened was, I'm sure you've come across Pete Fogel.
Yeah,
I
I
got
haven't
to know.
talked to him much, but I know of him and I've talked to him a little bit.
You haven't interviewed him yet.
I have not, no, not yet.
No. Anyway, because Pete was a subscriber and he was in New York, it kind of eventually made sense for him and a friend of his called Bill Pascador to kind of take over the magazine, which is what happened. But what would happen was, I would write questions for an interview with George Wodenius or whoever it might be, Rosie Vila, and they would interview these people, and then I would transcribe the interview. So, whilst the magazine then was kind of based in New York, I was still doing a fair bit of the stuff,
Yeah. So what were like what kind of stuff, was it mostly just the interviews in the magazine or were there other features as well? Like what were, because I haven't, I don't have any copies of it.
No, you just have a kind of a news section really with, what the latest was going on, if Donald had a new solo album coming out or whatever, stuff like that, singles, that premiere articles, and then interviews, with musicians, because, of course, 1989, Donald played in the Lone Star. And that gradually expanded, and you had Jimmy Vivino and people like that, Phoebe Snow, and so there would be interviews with people like that.
Now, did you ever try to reach out to Donald or Walter for an interview?
Yes, I did. I certainly did for the bio anyway.
Of course.
What happened was, in 1996, I went to Dublin to see Steely Dan in a concert there with Dave, my friend. And we were in Tower Records on a Sunday afternoon, and I spotted Walter and his wife in the store.
Oh, wow.
And I said to Dave, I said, bloody hell, Walter's over there. So I kind of stalked him around the store. waiting for the right moment, and went up and introduced myself, and he introduced me to his wife, and then Dave was introduced and all that. And I think it was the final night of the European tour, so Walter said, "Oh, we're having a party after the show at such and such a hotel," so we got an invite to the after show party, which was great,
Oh, wow.
So we were in the bar of the hotel, and food and drink courtesy of Steely Dan, and Walter and Donald were there, and Donald looking extremely uncomfortable as he generally does in those kind of situations. But yeah, I did. That was actually before that. I contacted Walter to say, I was going to try and write this bio, and would like to interview him. And he rang me late one night. My phone rang. I had no clue who it was. I presume he was in Maui, so we've got 10-hour time difference. And we had a little chat, and he said, "No, I don't think Donald and I want to be interviewed for the book." but carry on as if Donald and I were dead, you know. So that's exactly what I did. But I think, you know, I interview, you know, Denny Diaz, Roger Nichols, Gary Katz, you know, loads of studio musicians, interviewed Donald's mum. She provided me with some photographs, you know, for the bio. So,
and that was for the book, not for the magazine, right?
Yeah, not for the magazine, no, no.
So after you did the magazine for 4 years, then you started to prep the Reelin' in the Years?
Yeah, I guess because the bio originally came out in 94. You know, probably spent about 18 months doing that. So, you know, talking, you know, kind of 92-ish. Maybe a little bit of overlap there. But then I was kind of trying to get on with the bio, really.
So the history of Steely Dan, I mean, it's a pretty rich text. There's a lot of incredible pieces of trivia, you know, interesting characters that are coming in and out. Is that part of what appealed to you as someone who, you know, was writing this magazine and then later the biography? Were you particularly taken with the kind of lore of Steely Dan in addition to the music itself?
Yes, absolutely. I think because, you know, they had so many characters and places and you know, you would want to know, you know, about those places and those characters, you know, Kathy Barbarian and so on, you know, and all those exotic drinks they mention in their lyrics and stuff. So it's been a real, you know, wonderful thing for me because, you know, it's broadened my mind and, you know, I want to find out more about this and that, you know, and a lot of it's been, you know, prompted by stuff in Steely Dan lyrics, really, and, you know, solo stuff as well as Steely Dan. So.
Now, while you were writing this biography, something interesting happened, which is that Steely Dan began the process of reforming, right?
Yeah.
What was seeing that happen, like, as you were writing the bio?
Yeah, well, I came to New York in 93, and I saw them in Madison Square Garden. And I also saw them at Jones Beach, I believe. Good memories. Obviously, it's, you know, moved on a lot tour-wise since then, hasn't it? You know, many, many tours. So.
Yeah, it's been going on for 30 years. What was the MSG show like? Do you remember anything specific about your reaction or your feelings?
It was very exciting. Obviously, I didn't ever see them in the 70s. They did play in Bristol, which is about 30 miles from where I am. But I was only 15. I was still at school and obviously didn't have any money. I wasn't really going to concerts when I was 15. Yeah. So that was a bit of a shame. But first time I saw them probably must have been Madison Square Garden, I would think. I saw Donald, you know, at the Lone Star and, you know, a couple of those local New York things he did, sort of 89, 90 and so on. New York Rock and Soul Review, I also saw. So
oh, you did see those?
Yeah. Yeah.
How were those?
They were good, but not as good as Steely Dan.
Yeah, well, it was a bit of a different... they weren't playing that many Steely Dan songs, and it was a bit kind of more impromptu, I feel like, than maybe a Steely Dan show, from what I've read.
Yeah, a bit of a soul, heavy soul thing going on in those, you know. I suppose Boz is a soul fan, and obviously Donald is, and that, so.
And that ultimately kind of led to the Dukes of September. Have you ever seen them?
No, I haven't seen Dukes. No.
So you saw those couple shows at in New York. Has you finished the book by then or not?
Not quite sure, actually. Possibly not. I think August 94 it came out. So probably had to deliver it, early part of 94, I would think. So possibly not.
And did you see them? Did you come back to the States to see them again, like any other times in the 90s or even after that?
I saw them 2003, saw them in Roseland. I've done a fair bit of crossing the Atlantic to see them, and I've seen them in Dublin, seen them in Birmingham, seen them in London. I've been clocked up a few miles over the years.
Shifting gears from the chronology to more your relationship with the music. I mean, what is it about Steely Dan, that appeals to you the most? Like, what drew you in? Was it kind of the jazz inflected rock of it, or kind of the lyrical universe, or kind of just everything altogether? I mean, was there, why do you love Steely Dan? Why does it kind of become this lifelong thing for you?
I think way back in the 70s when I was younger, I really think it was Donald's voice. I did absolutely love his voice. So that kind of drew me in as much as anything. And then certainly, once you were able to get a lyric sheet and read the lyrics or try and decipher the lyrics.
It's interesting that you said the voice. So, what are your thoughts on the songs that are not sung by Donald? Are they not rated as highly for you for that reason? I mean, there's only a handful, but.
Yes. Well, I mean, I absolutely love Midnight Cruiser, which is Jim Hodder, of course. And I think Jim does a great, vocal on that. I'd love to hear, a version of it with Donald singing. But
Walter did
Midnight.
sing it once live. I don't know if you've
Yes.
seen that.
Yes. Yeah, it's such a great shame that Jim Hodder died early 90s there. And then Walter said that was a real old song, even when they recorded it for Can't Buy a Thrill. So never heard a demo or anything of it. All those pre-Steely Dan demos, which are out in abundance, never anything appeared there. So.
Yeah. Do you enjoy those as well? The demos?
Yeah, I do.
Any particular
But
favorites among those? Because they haven't really been properly organized into a release. They're just kind of out there, and there's no kind of we don't have an official album of them or anything. It's just kind of like there's 100 of these different bootlegs, so.
yes, yeah. Again, I can clearly remember I was in a record store, must have been in the 1980s. And I was, filing through the CDs, and I came across the early years, which had been put out by Kenny Vance. And that was like getting gold dust in my hands when I saw that.
Yeah, because again, this is pre-internet, so listeners now, everything's on YouTube. With the click of a mouse, we can hear all these songs, but this was a different time.
Yes, and it had a really great photo on the cover, of Donald wearing this sort of like a private investigator Mac, Macintosh type thing, and dishevelled hair, and obviously Brain Tap Shuffle, and the old regime, and Soul Ram, etc., etc. That was great. I remember coming across that.
Did you pick up on the Steely Dan reference in Soul Ram when you first listened
Yes, absolutely,
to
Baby, let it grow. She's got a soul ring in her hand. Never knew she'd dug the heavy stuff. Steely Dan, play it rough. Back door.
And I actually learned in your book that Donald and Walter were under the influence of LSD when they wrote Brain Tap Shuffle. Is that true?
Well, I think so. I can't exactly remember where I saw that or heard that, but makes sense, doesn't it, when you read the lyrics?
The lyrics are kind of gibberish, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was also a passage in Donald's autobiography in Eminent Hipsters about him trying LSD for the first time, which was interesting because I don't necessarily associate, you know, Donald Walter with kind of psychedelia, but I guess he seemed to have a positive take on it. So,
yeah. Well, of course, in that KPFK interview, which I mentioned earlier, they actually kind of opened the phone lines and people were able to ring in with questions. And so one guy rang in, you know, and sounded kind of drunk or something. And he said, Donald, I'm wondering, what do you think of drug abuse? And Donald says, I'm going to defer to my partner who can answer that from a point of more experience than myself.
Yeah.
Which was brilliant.
Yeah. Well, certainly during the kind of Gaucho era, I know that it had become, you know, not just a casual or recreational thing, but a serious, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think, you know, obviously we didn't know at the time because I mentioned that 1981 interview with Robert Palmer in the New York Times with Donald, you know, and he sort of said, oh, you know, after 14 years of writing and recording together, we need to take a break from each other, you know. But yes, I think much, much later on, you know, Donald would say, yeah, Walter was being late for recording sessions and not turning up for recording sessions, you know. Extremely difficult to work with, really. So I guess after Gaucho, he thought, you know, had enough, really.
Yeah. When you tried to interview Donald and Walter for the book, were you discouraged when they, you know, didn't agree to participate? Or did you, you know, was that okay with you?
No, I don't think I was. I was probably secretly quite pleased because I think it would have been pretty stressful trying to interview them for a bio and you know, knowing the intellect and all that stuff, so you know, it was a kind of a different challenge without them on board, but like you say, in a way it's kind of sometimes good, you know. You don't want to meet, you know, your heroes.
Right.
Although
you met them, right? At the party.
Yes. Yeah. I did. I ambushed Walter in Tower Records in Dublin in 96. And I ambushed Donald in New York because I was over there for the Lone Star shows. And I knew he was recording an interview with, I don't know, somebody like Pat St. John on WNEW, I think. So of course I went down and found where the WNEW studios were and waited for Donald to arrive. So I had a copy of Metal Leg with me and a vinyl copy of Asia. He walked right past the studio. So I said, Donald, I think this is what you're looking for, and showed him, you know, where to go. And, would you mind autographing my copy of, Asia? And, this is a Steely Dan fanzine that I've started and been running for the last couple of years. So he autographed my copy of Asia and, you know, scuttled up over the stairs to the studio.
Yeah. What do you think of kind of Donald's attitude towards the fandom? Because it seems like, you know, I was reading, you know, either an interview or in his book, you know, he calls a lot of the fans TV babies. You know, they're only at his shows because they want to hear, you know, those old songs from back in their time.
Yes.
And I know he tends to keep a little bit of distance from the fans. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think a lot of that is tongue in cheek, to be fair. As I say, seeing Donald in that Dublin hotel, you know, he was kind of nursing a Coke, and you know, his shoulders were hunched, and he looked, you know, not comfortable in the slightest, really. I think he likes to maintain his distance, perhaps, shall we say, and
I mean, in an alternate, you know, universe, he could have easily been, you know, an English professor or something, right? He's not he's not your prototypical kind of rock star in either his look or his demeanor.
No, exactly. And you know, he said on several occasions, you know, if he hadn't been a musician and songwriter, then you know, he might have been teaching English or working in a bookstore or something, you know.
Yeah. What's the fandom like in England? I think I saw that Haitian Divorce is actually their most popular song there. Is that true?
Yeah, I believe it got to number 17. The singles never did quite, you know, do as well as maybe they ought to have. But I can clearly remember Haitian Divorce on the radio in 1976. You know, great song, but as it's not, you know, your normal sort of 45 type stuff, you know, maybe a bit too complex, you know, to be, you know, a number one or even a top five hit, maybe.
Well, yeah, it's just funny that that song was the one that made any kind of impact, because, you know, here it made zero impact. I don't think it was even on the charts. And even among other Steely Dan fans that I talked to, it's a bit divisive. Like, some love it, but some don't like it. So it's just interesting that that's the one that had a kind of broader popularity. Yeah. Over.
I mean, they did some pretty big interviews in 76 for the Royal Scam. You know, the music papers over here, Melody Maker, New Musical Express and Sounds. They did a very extensive interview with Michael Watts in the Melody Maker in the summer of 76. I mean, whether that would have, you know, really affected Haitian Divorce like 6 months later, I'm not really sure, but maybe their profile had been raised a bit. So just a shot in the dark, really.
Do you have any plans to do Steely Dan related things in the future, or are you just gonna?
I'm just cruising along at the moment. Really.
Okay.
We did update, when after Walter passed away. As I say, because I mean, originally it came out in '94, so that's nearly 30 years ago. So you know, an awful lot has happened since then. So. Kind of makes sense to update, you know. Of course, they're coming out on tour with the Eagles, aren't they?
Yeah, and
will you go?
No, I won't, because a couple reasons. And I said this on the podcast, and I hope, you know, I wonder if fans were offended, but you know, my take on it is, I don't mind being critical of you know, Steely Dan sometimes. Just I like to have that freedom. But my first problem is just that I don't really like seeing shows at arenas in general, because it's just the sound is not always that great and you can't really see a lot of the band. And I mean, mainly it's just the tickets prices are absurd. Like I see like decent seats for those shows are going for like $500.
Really?
Yeah. So it's just crazy. And I'm not really an Eagles fan. So, you know, you'd be paying more, you know, more of the cost of that ticket is really to see the Eagles.
Yes.
Steely Dan's just opening. So, you know, they're only going to play for maybe 45 minutes. So to me, it's not worth it.
No.
But I did get to see them at the Beacon a few times, and those shows, you know, I did pay, yeah, I paid like $125, I think, last time I saw it. That was worth it because it was, there was no opener. It was just Steely Dan. They played for almost 2 hours, and the sound and the atmosphere was great. And, you know,
yeah.
I sat pretty close. So, yeah. I don't, have you seen them at the Beacon Theater? Any chance?
Yes,
chance?
Yes, I have actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So if they did more Beacon shows, I would pony up for that, but not for these Eagles shows.
No. Yeah. Well, obviously Irving Azoff must be behind that.
Yeah, there's no question. Irving got his paws into that situation. It's funny because actually I know that. The sort of younger generation of Steely Dan fans, they're not cool with the Eagles. Like the Eagles are still kind of, well, I guess they used to be considered cooler because you know, they sold a lot of records, but it's funny because there was a time when both Steely Dan and the Eagles were seen as the music beloved by our parents' generation. And now Steely Dan has kind of been, you know, there's a reclamation project going on with them where the younger folks see them as hip and sort of anti-authority, but not with the Eagles. The Eagles are still seen as kind of, you know, something that really is more for our parents and not for us. So,
yeah. I think there are going to be more dates next year, aren't there? I think I read or saw somewhere that 2024, they're going to do some more together, aren't they?
I don't know. I mean, I know that the Eagles are going to be going for a while. I don't know how much of that Steely Dan will be joining for. I would hope that Steely Dan does some of their own stuff next year. That's what I'm kind of crossing my fingers, because, again, I don't really feel much need to see the Eagles, so I don't want to have to pay for that part of the ticket. You know, if I can see Steely Dan alone for, you know, $100 to $200, you know, that's sort of... But, you know, or also, you know, if someone could get me a ticket for free somehow, as I'm...
Alex, do you think we'll get another solo album from Donald?
Well, there was a Rolling Stone thing about Donald saying that he was doing another album, but that was a long time ago, so I don't know. There's been no follow-up on that.
I saw that article, so he said he'd written some songs, you know, during lockdown and stuff. And he liked them, which was quite something, because, you know, he quite often said he'd be writing a song, didn't really like what he did, you know. So, yeah, I'm wondering whether he's been in the studio. 2012 was Sunken Condo, so 11 years, so time for another one, really.
Yeah, he tends to do one per decade, so I think it's time for the next one. He did Nightfly, Comicuriad, Morph, and Sunken. You know, four albums, 4 decades. It's time for number 5. So yeah, hopefully he'll get back in there at some point this year or next year.
Johnny Bone.